Hello, and welcome to Legal Bites. If you're new here, my name is Alita. I'm a lawyer licensed in California and DC, and on this channel, we explain the law one bite at a time. We don't give legal advice, but we do talk about how the law works and try to look into our crystal ball to see how things might turn out. If you're enjoying this on YouTube, we'd love it if you could like the video, subscribe to the channel, share it with friends, all the great YouTube-y stuff. And if you want to listen while out and about, we're now offering our live streams in podcast form where you can leave a rating and review. Links are in the description below, as well as to our clips channel where you can find some of the best clips taken from our live streams. Otherwise, if you want to catch me elsewhere, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you want to support the channel, you can do so on Locals, Patreon, or by becoming a YouTube member, or by buying some really awesome Legal Bites merch. Again, all links are in the description below. And with that said, let's get into it.
All right. Happy Tuesday. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are out there in the world watching. I appreciate you being here with me today to talk about this subject. So first off, some hellos. Hi, Marion Williams from Sin City, Las Vegas. Good to see you. Also, Shindog City from the gateway to scenic South Central Indiana. See there, I did read the whole thing. Annalie Finch from Virginia. Hello, hello. Lena Palmquist from Sweden. Caitlin Klein from Minnesota. Hi, how are you? We've got another hello from Sweden, from Sabina Larson. We've got from Virginia. I'm so sorry, I can't read your name. we've got the Chicken Coop from Kentucky. We've got Wish on a Fish from Michigan. Awesome. Awesome. B from Germany. Love it. I love to see it. Love to see you guys here. And we've got a hello from Utah. We are going to be talking about some Utah law today a little bit, as well as the UK. Always folks from the UK. And Wahi, New York City. Brazil. I love it. I love it. I love it. Love to see all of you guys, all these wonderful faces here. And I appreciate all of you guys coming in to say hi and learning some law and trying to figure out what's what in all of these different cases. So today, obviously, we've got another sad case. Yesterday, we talked about a tragic case that was very similar to this one in a lot of ways, right? Because you have a relationship that is apparently fraught with issues over time, and turns out that there was some sort of violence involved in that relationship. And it ended up with one of them not surviving the relationship. And so it's just, it's an absolute tragedy all the way around. We're talking, of course, about Gabby Petito, who it's almost like exactly a year from today, almost, that she went missing. Maybe like a week from now or something, it'll be the 1 year anniversary. But so another very, very, very sad case. The family of Gabby Petito, I really applaud them in some ways because of the way in which they have tried to use this tragedy to enact some sort of changes and to bring the issue of DV to the forefront. And they've really tried to work hard on really just making some sort of good out of this, because this is obviously a case where you have a death that is absolutely senseless, right? There's no good reason for someone like Gabby Petito to have died, especially at her age and the way in which she did. And this is also, of course, a lot of the commentary around this case also includes the fact that, you know, she is a beautiful blonde young woman, or she was. And you know, that was one of the reasons perhaps as to why this case got so much media attention. There are plenty of other cases where a young man or a young woman or a young child goes missing. And oftentimes there'll be someone who's of a minority or just doesn't exactly look like someone like Gabby Petito, who was a beautiful young woman. And they don't get the same sort of media attention. And then there's all kinds of questions about whether or not they could have been saved, you know, if they had the same sort of like immediate sort of media acting and trying to have people like crowdsource information, right, to find people. And that was one of the ways that they found her remains so quickly, was because someone essentially recognize the van from their own social media activity. So anyhow.
I'm unmuted, but I need to make sure the right mic.
Okay. That should be the right mic. Okay. Sorry about that. This wire still likes to go loose. Okay. We're back. We're back. And we're back with the good audio from the right mic. And so anyway, but one of the issues with this is they've also started a lot of litigation, and it seems like they have been trying to find, like I said, some sort of meaning in the senselessness of her death. Because when you have someone that is taken from you so suddenly, and you don't even get that sort of closure because they couldn't even see Brian Laundrie put on trial, because then, you know, he wandered off into the Florida wetlands or marshlands or what have you, and then ended up committing suicide. So they weren't even able to have like a criminal trial to put him on trial to, so that they could see some sort of justice. You know what I mean? So I, you know, this is me sort of like hypothesizing and also sort of pulling on some of my experience of working with families in the trusts and wills and trusts sort of area where people are grieving oftentimes through litigation because a family member has died and they don't quite know how to deal with all of the feelings and all of the things that happened in this person's life or in the life of the people around them. And so sometimes people grieve in funny ways, and sometimes people grieve by starting litigation because it's almost as if. And you'll see this also in family law with divorce cases, where sometimes you'll see a couple that continues to fight for years and years and years after the relationship has ended. And it's almost as if they've gotten so used to fighting that they don't know how to stop fighting, because in some way it keeps that other person in their life. And so sometimes I have had this theory for a long time that when someone is grieving, sometimes I think that it is always a possibility. I'm not saying that this is what's happening here, but it's always a possibility that someone might start litigation because they don't know how to close that door, or because they are not exactly ready to close that door. Does that make the litigation right? No, not necessarily. No. Sometimes, you know, you might have merit to it, but they tried suing Brian Laundrie's parents, and that was thrown out pretty quickly. They have now also filed a notice against the Utah police to say that they are preparing to file a lawsuit for essentially negligence. And we're going to go through the notice of claim, and we're going to go through some case law, both from the United States Supreme Court and from Utah appellate case law as well, just to kind of go through what we think about the likelihood of this particular case. So first off, 2012 Jameson, thanks so much for the super chat. Says, this might be a good public policy case. Sorry, excuse me. But hard case to win legally. DV cases for cops is a hard one on both sides. Yeah. No, I basically, cat's out of the bag. I feel very similarly about this one. Okay. Let's get into, with all of that said, let's get into the actual notice, shall we? Oh, and to answer the question here from Isabel Lindsay, are they suing the Moab Police Department or the state of Utah? Well, this is everyone that they are suing here. There's going to be a number of folks. We're going to get into all of them. And then also, when was Petito v. Laundrie dismissed? I can't remember, but it was filed. Oh gosh, when was it? When was it even filed? I remember doing a live stream for it, but it was like maybe a few months after, or like a month or two or something after Brian Laundrie was found, or his remains were found. So, gosh, I don't know. But I think it was like a month or two later. It was pretty, they filed a motion to dismiss. And then I think it was pretty quickly dismissed, was from my recollection. Okay. So, all right, let's get into this. Oh, Katie Cotton says it was filed in June. I don't know if it was dismissed yet. I don't know if, unless there's a second one that has been filed that I am not actually familiar with. So, okay. Let me clarify then on that. The one that I remember, you know what, let me go back into my, give me one second here. Let me go back into my live streaming history here. Because I remember doing this one. Okay, hang on a second. Sorry, guys. So March was when I did a live stream on a complaint. So, okay. Well, I'm getting corrected on that. If it may have been refiled is another possibility. Okay. Anyway, well, let's get into this one at any rate. Okay. So this was August 5th. So we're talking 11 days ago that this was filed with the state of Utah. It says, to whom it may concern, pursuant to the Utah Governmental Immunity Act, Utah Code Section 63G-7-401, Joseph and Tara Petito and Nicole and Jim Schmidt hereby serve this notice of claim on their own behalf and on behalf of their daughter, Gabrielle Gabby Venora Petito, deceased, against the Moab City Police Department and against department employees Chief Brett Edge, Assistant Chief Braden Palmer, Officer Eric Pratt, Officer Daniel Robbins, and Jane/John Doe's 1 through 10. Statement of facts. Brian Laundrie murdered Gabby Petito by strangling her and savagely inflicting. Oh, God. I totally forgot about this part. I'm so sorry. I was a lot better about this yesterday before getting into it. Trigger warning. If you're not familiar with this case, we're going to get into, I mean, I'm cat's out of the bag now with that last sentence, but we're going to talk about DV, domestic violence. We're going to talk about IPV, intimate partner violence. So all of these things could be triggering to a lot of people that are survivors. I know a lot of folks that are viewers since that trial are survivors of DV, of IPV. So keep that in mind as we continue on. Just want to give that, that note before we continue. And again, 2012 Jameson, thanks again for the super chat. It says, just being honest, instead of a lawyer, a lobbyist would be better for the parents. A law to make a change is more realistic. I think you're probably right. I think that they probably have a lot of good public sway for that too. Like a lot of the public would be probably in favor of some sort of changes in the law. On a broad scope. Okay. Okay. All right. So he murdered her shortly after the Moab City Police Department failed to adequately respond to reports and evidence of domestic violence between Brian and Gabby. Many facts related to this matter were widely reported in national and international media. The following briefly summarizes the primary events relevant to this notice. Gabby was an aspiring travel influencer, a van lifer who documented her travels on social media. In the summer of 2021, she and her fiance, Brian, were on a months-long trip visiting the Western United States. On August 12th, 2021, Gabby and Brian visited Moab, Utah. They spent much of the day in a coffee shop where Gabby worked on her social media business. Afterward, on the sidewalk outside of the Moonflower Community Cooperative, Brian and Gabby began to fight. A witness described them as talking aggressively in a way that led the witness to believe that something seemed off. The witness saw Brian take Gabby's phone, get into their van, and attempt to block Gabby from getting into the van. Gabby eventually climbed over Brian to get into the van. The witness's impression was that Brian appeared to be attempting to leave Gabby after taking her phone. Another witness to that incident called 911 and reported seeing Brian Laundrie slapping Gabby that he hit her while chasing her up and down the sidewalk before getting into their van and driving away. Police dispatch alerted officers to the report, including the fact that a witness had seen Brian assault Gabby. Officer Daniel Robbins found Brian and Gabby's van driving on the highway out of town. He saw it speeding, crossing the double yellow line, and swerving to hit the curb before stopping near the entrance to Arches National Park. Soon after, Pratt and two park rangers joined Officer Robbins at the scene. The officers separated Brian and Gabby in order to speak with them individually. When speaking with Gabby, Officer Robbins noted that she was visibly in crisis, crying uncontrollably. According to Officer Robbins' report, at no point during his interactions with Gabby did she stop crying, breathing heavily, or compose a sentence without needing to wipe away tears, wipe her nose, or rub her knees with her hands. He later explained that she didn't seem fully coherent to the world, not like she was intoxicated or under the influence, but her mind went into the black zone, so to speak. Officer Robbins also saw cuts on Gabby's cheek and arm. Gabby demonstrated how Brian had violently grabbed her face during their altercation and explained that Brian gets frustrated with me a lot. Indeed, the cut to Gabby's face was much more serious than may have been apparent in the body cam footage. Another photo taken at the time, which has not yet been released publicly, shows a close-up view of Gabby's face where blood is smeared on her cheek and left eye, revealing the violent nature of Brian's attack. The photo shows that Gabby's face was grabbed across her nose and mouth, potentially restricting her airway. When asked about her fight with Brian, Gabby displayed the classic hallmarks of an abused partner, attempting to take blame for the fight because she had hit Brian first and that she did not want to be separated from him. Whether for lack of training or refusal to follow their training, the officers did not press further. Brian told Officer Robbins that he and Gabby had been under increasing emotional strain, which led them to arguing more frequently over the previous few days. Brian claimed that when they were outside the co-op, Gabby believed Brian was trying to leave her in Moab without her cell phone, so she attempted to slap him. To avoid being slapped, Brian admitted he pushed Gabby away. He admitted taking her cell phone because he said, "I don't have a phone," and he was afraid that if she goes off without me, I'm on my own. But later in his interview with the officers, Brian pulled his own phone from his pocket and gave the officers his number. Brian also claimed that he had been attempting to separate himself from Gabby by convincing her that they should take separate walks in downtown Moab, apparently contradicting witnesses who had seen him attempting to leave in the van without Gabby. The officers did not question Brian about the inconsistencies in his version of events. Instead, they determined that Gabby was the primary aggressor and that Brian was a potential victim of domestic violence. Based on that determination, Officer Pratt explained to Brian and Gabby that the officers lacked any discretion but were required to charge Gabby and take her to jail. He also explained that Utah law automatically imposes a no-contact order to keep the parties to a domestic dispute separate, and that Brian would need to sign a waiver of that order in the morning if he wanted to reunite with Gabby. Both Brian and Gabby pleaded for some other way of resolving the problem. Officer Pratt called Assistant Chief Palmer to seek assistance on how to handle the situation. Chief Palmer instructed Officer Pratt to carefully read the assault statute and decide whether the situation satisfied the statute. Officer Pratt Googled the statute. After reading only the first half of the statute, Officer Pratt decided incorrectly the Utah law only recognizes assault if the perpetrator intended to cause bodily injury. Based on that incomplete and incorrect understanding of the law, Officer Pratt questioned Gabby about whether she intended to cause Brian bodily injury when she hit him. Gabby said no. Officer Pratt, the significantly more senior officer, told Officer Robbins to decide what to do. Officer Robbins said that he didn't entirely believe Gabby and decided to prepare a crime report. He decided not to impose charges at that time, but to allow the city attorney to screen the report and decide whether to press charges. Despite previously stating that he would support Officer Robbins' decision, Officer Pratt pushed back, warning Officer Robbins that if Brian and Gabby strongly disagree with his decision and they throw a complete fit, you might hear about it in a very negative way. One of the park rangers on the scene also pushed back, explaining that she would rather be dinged for a decision I made than a decision I didn't make. Officer Pratt added, especially if you think they think you were completely negligent in your decision. Even so, Officer Pratt again told officers that he would support Officer Robbins' decision. Officer Robbins then decided to issue a citation for domestic assault and go through the typical process. Again, despite repeated assurances that he would support Officer Robbins' decision, Officer Pratt asked if Officer Robbins would feel more comfortable responding to another dispatch call that had recently come in. Officer Robbins said he was uncertain of how to proceed. Officer Pratt suggested that the officers could separate Brian and Gabby for the night, but take no further action. Officer Pratt suggested that if Brian and Gabby later found each other, it wouldn't be the officer's responsibility. Consistent with Officer Pratt's suggestion, Officer Robbins found a place for Brian to stay for the night through a local domestic violence organization, Seek Haven, while allowing Gabby to keep and sleep in her van. While the police interviewed Brian and Gabby, Gabby was on the phone with her parents. They demanded that Gabby fly home to get away from Brian, offering to pay for her ride to Salt Lake City and fly her home. But upon learning the police were involved, they accepted Gabby's assurances that she should continue her trip. Roughly 2 weeks later, Brian brutally murdered Gabby, leaving her body in the woods at Grand Teton National Forest. In a subsequent review of the Moab police officers' handling of the incident, an independent investigator concluded that the officers made several mistakes and could not rule out that Gabby's murder might have been prevented if the officers had handled the situation properly. Nature of the claims. Joseph and Tara Petito and Nicole and Jim Schmidt hereby provide notice of claims for negligence that they intend to bring on their own behalf and on Gabby's behalf against the Moab Police Department, Assistant Chief Palmer, Officer Pratt, Officer Robbins, and Jane/John Doe's 1 through 10, the defendants collectively, for their negligent failure to understand and enforce the law of the state of Utah to investigate Brent's self-evidently false claims during their interviews with him, to properly train the officers to investigate domestic violence situations, and to properly assess the circumstances, including to identify Brian as the true primary aggressor. Additionally, Joseph and Tara Petito and Nicole and Jim Schmidt intend to bring claims on their own behalf and on Gabby's behalf for wrongful death against the defendants on the ground that Gabby's death was caused by their wrongful acts or neglect. Utah Code Section 78B-3-1061, providing when the death of a person is caused by the wrongful act or neglect of another, his heirs or his personal representatives for the benefit of his heirs, may maintain an action for damages against the person causing the death. Damages incurred. As a result of the defendant's wrongful acts and neglect, Joseph and Tara Petito's and Nicole and Jim Schmidt's daughter was brutally murdered. Although their damages are not amenable to precise calculation, they have suffered, among other things, a loss of society, comfort, association, love, counsel, care, consortium, and protection, loss of the reasonable expectation to associate with Gabby, the value of services Gabby would have provided, and other special and general damages. Similarly, as a result of the defendant's wrongful acts and neglect, Gabby suffered personal injuries resulting in death, pain, emotional distress, mental anguish, impaired earning capacity, lost wages, and other general and special damages. Joseph and Tara Petito and Nicole and Jim Schmidt are seeking $50 million in damages based on the claims set forth above. Sincerely, and this is from the attorneys of the four plaintiffs. So that is the notice of claim. So what they are required to do in a situation like this, when they are suing the government, is first, at least in the state of Utah, they are required to file a notice of claim first, and it gives them, I think, 30 days to respond. And then if there is no response, or if there is a particular kind of response, then they can actually file a civil lawsuit in court. All right. So here is, okay. Okay. So here's the actual Utah code section that they cited to, which is basically the wrongful death statute. So somebody causes the death of another person, they are basically held responsible under this code section. So basically that's what it says, except as provided in Title 34A, Chapter 2, Workers' Compensation Act, when the death of a person is caused by the wrongful act or neglect of another, his heirs or his personal representatives, for the benefit of his heirs, may maintain an action for damages against the person causing the death, or if the person is employed by another person who is responsible for his conduct, then against the other person. So basically, in order to have a claim like this, they have to allege that there was some sort of let me see here. Hang on a second. I closed out a screen that I should not have closed out so quickly. So for this particular case, they're saying it's the negligent failure to understand and enforce the law of the state of Utah. So at the heart of this is a negligence claim. So, the shaking was because of Indy. She walked by. So for negligence, there are four main elements to negligence. The first is that there is a duty, that the defendant has some sort of a duty to the plaintiff or to the person who died, if it's a wrongful death, death case. So duty, breach of that duty, damages as a result, and causation. Now, when we're talking about causation, we're talking not just about but for causation, as in, but for this activity, this result happened. But for the police not getting this particular call right, Gabby would be alive, right? Like that's but for causation, to say like that they stood in the line of events that occurred that led to her death. Another aspect though, in negligence cases, is it's not just about but for causation. They also have to show proximate causation, which basically is, or another term for that is legal causation. They have to show essentially foreseeability that something like this is something that they essentially, they're close enough in foreseeability that the officers could have foreseen something like this resulting, that she would die as a result of their screw up on this particular decision. Right, on not getting this right. And that's one of the issues that I think that was like one of the first things that I thought of when I heard about this particular case against the police, because realistically, the main central cause of her death is Brand Laundry. Like he's the core central person. And so to hold the police responsible for something that he did, they are one degree of separation outside of that at the very least. And it's a tough one to extend that far, I think, in my opinion. Now, on top of that, there is also a couple Supreme Court opinions about the duty aspect And whether the police actually even have a duty to her in this particular case. So there's a couple of cases that I'm going to read from, and I'm going to do the syllabus because that's basically just the quick summary of the case without getting too into, because these opinions can go for a very long time. So first, I will share this one. We've got DeShaney v. Winnebago City Social Services Department. Okay, this is a case from 1989, but it's still good law. This is a case where it says, okay, petitioner is a child who was subjected to a series of beatings by his father with whom he lived. Respondents, a county department of social services, and several of its social workers received complaints that petitioner was being abused by his father and took various steps to protect him. They did not, however, act to remove petitioner from his father's custody. Petitioner's father finally beat him so severely that he suffered permanent brain damage and was rendered profoundly, I don't want to use this word because I know that this is a word from 1989, but basically mentally incompetent. Petitioner and his mother sued respondents under 42 U.S. Code Section 1983, alleging that respondents had deprived petitioner of his liberty interest in bodily integrity in violation of his rights under the substantive component of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause by failing to intervene to protect him against his father's violence. The district court granted summary judgment for respondents, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. And this is what the Supreme Court held in that case, where, I mean, this is, it feels kind of similar to this one, but maybe even worse, because of the fact that we've got complaints to social services and they didn't act on it. Complaints about multiple acts of physical violence by the father against the son. So this is what the Supreme Court held. They said respondent's failure to provide petitioner with adequate protection against his father's violence did not violate his rights under the substantive component of the Due Process Clause. And here's why. Part A, a state's failure to protect an individual against private violence generally does not constitute a violation of the Due Process Clause because the clause imposes no duty on the state to provide members of the general public with adequate protective services. The clause is phrased with a limitation on the state's power to act, not as a guarantee of certain minimal levels of safety and security, while it forbids the state itself to deprive individuals of life, liberty, and property without the due process of law, its language cannot fairly be read to impose an affirmative obligation on the state to ensure that those interests do not come to harm through other means. And then this is part B. There is no merit to petitioner's contention that the state's knowledge of his danger and expressions of willingness to protect him against that danger established a quote-unquote special relationship, giving rise to an affirmative constitutional duty to protect. So in other words, Let me back up here. I'll summarize a little bit first. The part A here basically saying that there's no general duty. There has to be something specific that creates some sort of an affirmative duty by the police or by in this particular case, in the Supreme Court case, the social services department. So because there's no general guarantee by the government for your safety from other individuals. So here, there is no merit to petitioner's contention that the state's knowledge of his danger and expressions of willingness to protect him against that danger established a special relationship, giving rise to an affirmative constitutional duty to protect. While certain special relationships created or assumed by the state with respect to particular individuals may give rise to an affirmative duty enforceable through the Due Process Clause to provide adequate protection, the affirmative duty to protect arises not from the state's knowledge of the individual's predicament or from its expressions of intent to help him, but from the limitations which it has imposed on his freedom to act on his own behalf through imprisonment, institutionalization, or other similar restraint of personal liberty. No such duty existed here, for the harms petitioner suffered occurred not while the state was holding him in its custody, but while he was in the custody of his natural father, who was in no sense a state actor. While the state may have been aware of the dangers that he faced, it played no part in their creation, nor did it do anything to render him more vulnerable to them. Under these circumstances, the Due Process Clause did not impose upon the state an affirmative duty to provide petitioner with adequate protection. In other words, the fact that they failed to intervene in this particular case it sucks, it's tragic, but it doesn't give rise to liability by the state. And then we've got Part C. It may well be by voluntarily undertaking to provide petitioner with protection against a danger it played no part in creating, the state acquired a duty under state tort law to provide him with adequate protection against that danger. But the Due Process Clause does not transform every tort committed by a state actor into a constitutional violation. So that is from 1989. And then there's actually another case that sort of drives the point home a bit further, also from the United States Supreme Court. And this one is called Castle Rock v. Gonzalez. This is from 2005. All right, let's read the syllabus for this one. Okay. Respondent filed this suit under 42 U.S. Code Section 1983, just like the last one, alleging that petitioner violated the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause when its police officers, acting pursuant to official policy or custom, failed to respond to her repeated reports over several hours that her estranged husband had taken their three children in violation of her restraining order against him. Ultimately, the husband murdered the children. The district court granted the town's motion to dismiss, but an en banc majority of the 10th Circuit reversed, finding that respondent had alleged a cognizable procedural due process claim because a Colorado statute established the state legislature's clear intent to require police to enforce restraining orders, and thus its intent that the order's recipient have an entitlement to its enforcement. The court therefore ruled, among other things, that respondent had a protected property interest in the enforcement of her restraining order. And then this is what the Supreme Court held, that the respondent, meaning the mother in this case, did not for due process clause purposes have a property interest in police enforcement of the restraining order against her husband. And here's the reasons why. Part A. The Due Process Clause's procedural component does not protect everything that might be described as a government benefit. To have a property interest in a benefit, a person must have a legitimate claim of entitlement to it. So this is talking about how she had an actual restraining order against him. And they're saying that the question is whether she has a property right in the enforcement of that restraining order. Such entitlements are created by existing rules or understandings stemming from an independent source, such as state law. Part B, a benefit is not a protected entitlement if officials have discretion to grant or deny it. It is inappropriate here to defer to the 10th Circuit's determination that Colorado law gave respondent a right to police enforcement of the restraining order. This court therefore proceeds to its own analysis. Part C, Colorado law has not created a personal entitlement to enforcement of restraining orders. It does not appear that state law truly made such enforcement mandatory. A well-established tradition of police discretion has long coexisted with apparently mandatory arrest statutes. Against that backdrop, a true mandate of police action would require some stronger indication than the Colorado statute's direction to, quote unquote, use every reasonable means to enforce a restraint order, or even to arrest or seek a warrant. A Colorado officer would likely have some discretion to determine that, despite probable cause to believe a restraining order has been violated, the violation circumstances or competing duties counsel decisively against enforcement in a particular instance. The practical necessity for discretion is particularly apparent in a case such as this, where the suspected violator is not actually present and his whereabouts are unknown. In such circumstances, the statute does not appear to require officers to arrest, but only to seek a warrant. That, however, would be an entitlement to nothing but procedure, which cannot be the basis for a property interest. Part D, even if the statute could be said to make enforcement mandatory, that would not necessarily mean that respondent has an entitlement to enforcement. Her alleged interest stems not from common law or contract, but only from a state's statutory scheme. If she was given a statutory entitlement, the court would expect to see some indication of that in the statute itself. Although the statute spoke of protected persons, such as respondent, it did so in connection with matters other than a right to enforcement. Most importantly, it spoke directly to the protected person's power to initiate contempt proceedings if the order was issued in a civil action, which contrasts tellingly with its conferral of a power merely to request initiation of criminal contempt proceedings, and even more dramatically with its complete silence about any power to request, much less demand, that an arrest be made. And then finally, part E, even were the court to think otherwise about Colorado's creation of an entitlement, it is not clear that an individual entitlement to enforcement of a restraining order could constitute a property interest for due process purposes. Such a right would have no ascertainable monetary value and would arise incidentally, not out of some new species of government benefit or service, but out of a function that government actors have always performed, arresting people when they have probable cause. A benefit's indirect nature was fatal to a due process claim in O'Bannon v. Town Court Nursing Center. Here, as there, the simple distinction between government action that directly affects a citizen's rights and action that is directed against a third party and affects the citizen only, incidentally provides a sufficient answer to cases finding government-provided services to be entitlements. So in other words, one of the biggest issues in this case here was the fact that the police had discretion as to what to do in a situation where someone is in violation of a restraining order. And so it seems to me, I mean, although the notice of claim, it does talk about that he thought that he had mandatory, he was required by the law to do certain things. It sounds like that wasn't actually the case. And so where the police have discretion as to what to do, it looks like the Supreme Court is going to say, no, I'm sorry, you can't hold them liable where they are allowed to have some discretion and they can choose whether to take one route or another route. But now let's take a look at one last case. And this one is specific to the state of Utah, because here in the notice of claim, the Petito family and the Schmidt family, they cited to a particular code section, which actually is the Governmental Immunity Act of Utah, or the Immunity Act. And the reason why they cited to it is because they're required to, because of the notice of claim, it falls under that Immunity Act. But the Immunity Act actually gives the state immunity under particular circumstances. And so this case, actually the opinion in this Utah appellate case is actually fairly instructive on situations like this. So let's take a look at this one as well. Okay, let me make this bigger. Okay. Plaintiff Christy Pace appeals the trial court's dismissal of her complaint against defendants St. George City Police Department and St. George City. In dismissing plaintiff's complaint, the trial court determined that because plaintiff failed to strictly comply with the notice of claim service requirements of the Governmental Immunity Act of Utah, the trial court lacked subject matter jurisdiction over plaintiff's claim. The trial court further determined that even if the court had jurisdiction, dismissal was nonetheless appropriate because under the Immunity Act, defendants were immune from liability. Given our trepidation regarding the jurisdiction determination, we choose to affirm on the merits. Thus, for purposes of our analysis, we assume but do not decide that the trial court had subject matter jurisdiction. Background. On March 13th, 2004, the police arrested plaintiff's husband, William Matthew Pace, Mr. Pace, now deceased, for theft. At the time of the arrest, the police searched Mr. Pace but failed to discover a 9mm pistol that Mr. Pace had placed beneath a prosthetic back brace he was wearing. After his arrest and while in custody at the police department, Mr. Pace asked to use the restroom. The police granted Mr. Pace permission, escorted him to the restroom, and removed his restraints. In the restroom, Mr. Pace removed the gun from beneath his back brace and fatally shot himself. Following Mr. Pace's death, plaintiff served a notice of claim and a subsequent complaint upon defendants, arguing that the police were negligent and failing to properly search and secure the safety of Mr. Pace. On July 11, 2005, defendants moved to dismiss plaintiff's complaint on grounds that defendants were immune from any alleged liability because any purported injury arose out of, in connection with, or resulted from Mr. Pace's incarceration. The trial court granted defendants' motion to dismiss. Plaintiff appeals. Okay, and we're not going to go through the issue and standard of review. Okay, analysis. Plaintiff claims that the trial court erroneously granted defendant's motion to dismiss because defendants waived their governmental immunity under the Immunity Act when their search of Mr. Pace failed to reveal a gun that he subsequently used to take his own life. Generally, under the Immunity Act, governmental entities and each employee of a governmental entity are immune from suit from any injury that results from the exercise of a governmental function. So that's the baseline. This immunity, however, is waived when an injury is proximately caused by a negligent act or omission of an employee committed within the scope of employment. So then there's a possibility. But wait. Government immunity is not, however, waived if the injury arises out of, in connection with, or results from the incarceration of any person in any state prison, county, or city jail, or other place of legal confinement. On appeal, plaintiff argues that Mr. Pace was never incarcerated, and thus the incarceration waiver exception is inapplicable. When interpreting statutory language, the court has consistently looked first to the plain meaning of the statute. Moreover, the court assumes the legislature in each term advisedly and gives effect to each term according to its ordinary and accepted meaning. Although the Immunity Act does not define incarceration, the ordinary and accepted meaning of incarcerate is to imprison or to confine. Confinement is generally understood as the act of imprisoning or restraining someone. Moreover, the Utah Supreme Court has interpreted incarceration to mean being under the control of the state, or that a person cannot be released without some kind of permission. Here, the record undisputedly shows that at the time Mr. Pace killed himself, the police was under police control and could not be released without some kind of permission. Specifically, at the time he died, Mr. Pace was under arrest and in police custody, and police had escorted him to the police restroom, and the police removed his restraints only for the purpose of his using the restroom. Thus, we conclude that Mr. Pace's death occurred in connection with his incarceration in a place of legal confinement, and defendants were immune from liability. Whoops. Wanted to highlight this part. Conclusion, because we determined that Mr. Pace's suicide occurred in connection with his incarceration, as the term is used in the Immunity Act, we conclude that defendants were immune from suit. Therefore, we affirm the trial court's grant of defendants' motion to dismiss. So you can see these portions that I highlighted here as I was reading along. Because of the fact that in this particular case, this Pace v. St. George City, because of the fact that that this had to do with a decision about his confinement, a decision about it was in connection with his incarceration in a place of legal confinement, even though he was in a bathroom, he wasn't actually in a jail. It seemed like they had uncuffed him, so he was under less restraint in some respects than he was a few minutes before. But because of the fact that he was still under legal confinement, he was still under control of the state that fell under the immunity statute. And here in this particular case, my concern for the Petito family is that the decision that they are, that is at the heart of what they say gives rise to the liability, is a decision about confinement, about Gabby Petito's confinement versus Brian Laundrie's confinement. They were requiring them. They were putting them under the control of the state by separating them for a night. And then after that, letting them go. This is a decision that is in connection with that control by the state, which tells me that most likely what's going to happen in this particular case is that even if for some reason it doesn't fall under the Supreme Court case law that we went over, those two other opinions, we're talking about DeShaney v. Winnebago and Castle Rock v. Gonzalez. In this one, this is Utah state law right here. I think that this is likely to be dismissed under this particular immunity. So, and like I said, it's just like, it brings me zero joy to say that, because obviously we're talking about someone who shouldn't have died. We're talking about someone who, you know, everyone wants to see justice for Gabby Petito, right? I mean, it's a really sad case. And folks that have watched the body cam footage, I mean, you look at her and you think there's no way that she could be an aggressor / the aggressor in their relationship. But it's one of those times where sometimes what you want the law to do isn't necessarily what the law is designed to do. So I have my doubts about this particular case against the Utah police. But yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think? Let me know. Let me know in the chat. Let me know in the comments below. I'm very interested to hear other people's thoughts on this case, because it's so sad. It's such a tragic, heartbreaking case. Yeah, I don't think that her parents are going after money, by the way. I know that some people have said that they're getting, you know, greedy, or that they are doing this for money. I don't think so. I would strongly hesitate before accusing a grieving family of going after money after they've lost a family member. You know, it's the same thing like with Vanessa Bryant going after the LA Sheriff's Department. I don't think that she's doing that for the money. I think that she really is going for change, or trying to force some kind of change in the LA County policies between the Sheriff's Department and the Fire Department. And they may very well be trying to do that in this particular case as well. So, but I do agree with 2012 Jameson earlier, who super chatted, saying that they probably would do much better with hiring a lobbyist rather than some litigators to change this kind of stuff. So anyway, alrighty, with that, I wish I could end this on a positive note. But I hope that this video has found you in a good place. I hope that you're having a good Tuesday. I hope that your week so far has gone well, and I hope that the rest of your week goes well as well. And on Thursday, I'm not sure that I'll be live streaming tomorrow, but on Thursday I will be live streaming. I expect to have Dr. Honda on the channel from Psychology in Seattle. We're going to talk about the psychology of repressed memories. I know that there are a lot of folks that are interested in the Manson case and memories and the things that have been alleged around that case surrounding memories. So if you guys have any questions, I've posted on all the social media platforms to collect questions. If anybody has them, be sure to comment in those posts or reply to those posts wherever you find them. And I'll be looking to collect and see which ones I can put together into a bit of an interview and do a have a good discussion. So, Alrighty. Thank you everyone for joining me for this. And thank you for your kindness and empathy. And thank you, of course, to the mods for always marshaling really great conversation in the chat as well. Oh, and I think there was one question. One question from Lena Palmquist says, what kind of education do the police need in the US? Not much. Really not much. It's actually, I think it's like, what is it, like 6 weeks or something? It's something kind of shockingly low, the amount of training that they get before they actually get sent out into the field. Alrighty. Anyway, otherwise, bye guys. I'll see you in the next video.